at the end of the war, 18 days, and after the final battle of clubs between Bhima and Duryodhana, Duryodhana recriminated like anything against Krishna and the Pandavas, how in his particular case, it was a foul blow that actually downed him and was causing his death. And also throughout the whole war, it was Krishna's trickery that had actually gained them the victory. And in fact, if you remember above, the celestials were throwing down flowers and singing praises to Duryodhana when he said, you know, he'd done this, he'd done that, he'd acted truly according to the dharma of a kshatriya and so on. And the poor Pandavas were getting pretty depressed by it all. And so Krishna was quite frank with them. He said, I did these things for you, all the powers that he brought into being, like the, you know, the eclipse of the sun for the killing of Joyadratha, his head cut, all those sort of things for you, out of my affection for you, but also that this war should be won. And the big picture was, remember that in fact, Mother Earth had supplicated Vishnu, the Supreme Being, to help her to rid the enormous burden she was suffering under of the unrighteous and the unrighteousness of the earth at that time. And so Vishnu had incarnated as Krishna, and this to actually carry out this. And the war was really the result of trying to clear, it was a righteous battle, remember, to clear the unrighteous. And right from the beginning, Krishna had made it quite clear and that this war was going to be won. By hook or by crook, you could say the divine doesn't come to earth for any ifs and buts and any pussyfooting around. The job was going to be done by hook or by crook. And remember, right at the beginning, when the two lines of armies were drawn up on the first day, looking at each other across no man's land, Arjuna asked Krishna to go out and so he could look at the other side, they set up the formations and what have you. And when he saw his beloved grandfather and Drona and all these relations, what have you, his stomach turned, he couldn't do it. He slumped to the back of the chariot, his hair on end, his throat dry. He said, Arjuna cannot fight. I cannot fight this battle. Krishna would have none of that stuff at all. He said, it's your duty to fight. You're a kshatriya. And also, if you don't fight, you're just an instrument in this. If you don't fight, these people are dead already. Someone else will actually fight for them. But the interesting thing is, at this time, when really Krishna was explaining the situation of actually why he did what he did, he also mentioned that Pandava and allied armies wouldn't have won this war if Jarasandha and Sistupala had actually fought. These were two kings of eastern nations, very powerful. If you try and get the picture here to the extent, let me try if I can. Sri Aurobindo lays this out very nicely. He points out, in actual fact, at this time, there had been five great dynasties in India that had produced an imperialistic United India. And actually, as things were at the time of the Battle of Dhritarashtra and the Kurus and so on, there was a lot of thought and a lot of movement towards having another imperialistic India. And the only people really who had the capacity to do it were the Kurus. Kurus were made up of the Pandavas and Kauravas. You had and of course you'd expect this from Sri Aurobindo, very much a political turn to the thinking. But at that time, the Kurus, without doubt, were top dogs. Not outstandingly so, but they had intellectually and development in military power and administration of land and the size of the land, they were the greatest nation. But there were quite a few underneath them, but they weren't strong enough to actually take them on and take over that top dog position. You had that very close relationship with the Panchalas. Remember the Panchalas? They were Draupadi's people, right nearby them, a very powerful nation. And you had Kshalas, don't worry about all these names, they have the Bhojas, those three, the Panchalas, the Bhojas, and Kuru, made up of the central northern mass of very powerful states. And of course, there was Krishna's own people, Yadavas too, who were at Mathura, all in that central state. The actually, it's most interesting because there's a fine balance between these, what I call the second grade states, and Krishna's Yadavas. They were very warlike, and they're very smart. They're inventive, and they move very fast, and they were very high. In many ways, Krishna's people held the balance. Jarasandra, I best mentioned about him, Madhavas, they were gaining strength. They were actually becoming another imperialistic nation. They'd actually conquered, at the time of the battle, 85, or might have been 86, 85 kings of neighboring states had been imprisoned. And when it got to 100, when Jarasandha had conquered 100, because he was a great devotee of Shiva, he was actually going to sacrifice them all. And a lot of the states around there were looking to him, to his state, to become the next imperialistic leader of India. And in other words, he was throwing an imbalance to the balance that there was there at the moment. The last thing that most of these nations wanted was a battle. Think of all the resources and money and death and what have you. It suddenly put the economies, the status quo had been broken by battle. It's the last thing they wanted. But in Jarasandha's case, not at all. Jarasandha is very interesting, really, because his nation was one of the original five great empires, and he was his father was called Brihadratha, nice man, and he married two sisters, and they were twins. It was a very happy family, but he was in many ways the architect of the revival of the powers of their state. And it's quite a sweet story in that they were a very happy family. As I say, the architect was the father, the sad thing was he hadn't had any children. Two wives, lovely wives, and they got on all very well. And one of the holy men called in, as they did from time to time, and he was very well looked after by the father. He was, you know, well fed and looked after, given this and given that, what have you. And the holy man said to the father, "What can I do for you? You've looked after me so well, and I'm grateful for that." And the father said, "Well, it's a great sadness to me that, in actual fact, I've had no children. And to have a son to continue the line is really what I'd like." So the holy man did, he got a mango and he poured a certain powers, chants, and this sort of thing, and gave it to the king and said, "Give it to your wife, and then you'll be able to have a child." Well, he was very fond of both his wives, and he cut it in half and gave them half each. And what happened after the normal sort of period of time was, in fact, they both gave birth to a child, but it wasn't a whole child, it was a half child. Half a mango, half a child. And the servants were so upset about this, obviously the mothers were, the queens were, that they really wanted to hush it up, and they threw the fleshy things out into outside of the palace gates. Well, there was a Rakshasi called Jara. She used to live around that area there, and she'd live on the scraps, and she was allowed, you know, she didn't cause any problems. She had seen these two bits of flesh, and she thought, well, there's a meal for here. Remember, Rakshasas were flesh eaters. And so she picked the two halves up, and she put it in a basket, prepared to go back home. But when she put it in the basket, suddenly the two locked together, rather like magnets coming together, and there was a beautiful little baby. Anyway, she was surprised at this, but she realized what must have happened. And so she actually went back to the king, because she knew there'd be a nice reward for her for this, gave him the little baby. And of course, they were delighted. She was given a permanent home in the area, looked after, and all this sort of stuff. Anyway, that is how Jarasandha came into being. And when he did, the prophets and soothsayers said that in actual fact he was going to be a great warrior, virtually invincible, and that he would be a great leader of men. And also in the neighboring state at that time was the born was Sistupala, and we hear of him at the Rajasuriya, but he worked very close to Jarasandha. In fact, Sistupala, that was king at the time we're talking about, we'd been killed then actually, but just before the battle, he was the marshal for Jarasandha, and the two worked very close together. And it's really, if you could say, the combined efforts of them that had produced such a powerful states. And what Trishna could see was that if in fact they came into being, the Rajasuriya just would not be able to be put into effect. It would be opposed by Jarasandha and Sistupala. Now the Rajasuriya is it's an imperialistic sacrifice that has gone into with the consents of the Kshatriyas, the leading warriors of the country, for the king to become an emperor and to actually become the leader, the imperialistic leader of the whole of the nation, the whole of India. But it had to be agreed, and it was a ritualistic sacrifice, very similar, if you remember, to the Ashwamedha. The Ashwamedha, the horse sacrifice, I'm sure many have heard about that, which Yudhishthira did right at the end of the battle. It's a little bit different, but the same. They ran in peril. The Rajasuriya was, armies were sent out from the king who wanted to become an emperor, and they approached all the other states, and they said, we want you to become part of our empire. You pay tribute to us, and you come see us regularly, and certain taxes and things. And if they didn't, they'd fight it out, and the winner, they won. The imperialistic armies won, then in fact they would come under the cloak of the imperial power. The Ashwamedha, somewhat similar, but remember, a horse was put down. There's a bit of sacrifice and the various bits and pieces that went with that. And the army followed, wherever the horse went, the state with which the horse moved into was challenged. And again, if they accepted the challenge and agreed to be a part of the imperialistic setup, that was fine. If didn't, they were fought out. It was fought over, and if they were beaten, then automatically they came into the net of the imperialistic. Well, actually, not a lot of difference. But actually, the Rajasuriyas are a lot cheaper because, of course, a lot more expensive because whole armies were sent all over the place. And what Krishna was saying was that in actual fact, if you can get Jarasandha out of the way, then in fact, not only will you get him out of the way because his powerful situation would mean it's a block to you, it'd be very difficult to do so, but he had 85, 86 kings locked up and they would all go with you. And what happened was that Krishna said the only way is he's got to be killed. There's a pity ridicule. His father's a nice man, I think. He's a very honourable man. Jarasandha was a bit of a tyrant, seemingly so, from the Mahabharata. And so it was determined that, in effect, Krishna, he was the leader of this, of the whole idea and how it should be done. Jarasandha got out of the way, leaving it open for Yudhishthira to become the emperor. And so Krishna said, Bhima should come with me, and so should Arjuna, and we can't beat them if we take them on army to army, but we can if we actually do a challenge to the king. And this is quite accepted as such. Anyway, without getting too long a story, they went in disguise as Brahmins, young Brahmins. A long way away, because in fact it was on the east side, remember, and we're talking about Hastinapura, which is pretty well the centre north of India. And they disguised, they got into, by trickery, they got into the well-reinforced battlements of the Magadha nation. And in actual fact, the king, Jarasandha, welcomed young Brahmins. They said who they were, why they were there. To cut a long story short, they challenged him. And he, luckily, it's a little bit like this, you know, with... when it came to Duryodhana and his battle, Duryodhana was given the opportunity of fighting any of those Pandavas or all of them. And the same thing really was put to Jarasandha. And he said, well, I'll fight one of you or I'll fight all three of you. And so Krishna said, well, choose the one that you want to fight. And fortunately, he chose Bhima, as he felt Bhima was the only really one that was a good challenge for him. It was a close fight. It lasted for 14 days, and eventually he was killed. But the interesting thing was actually that Jarasandha anointed his son. His name was Sahadeva before the battle. So he knew that, well, maybe he wasn't going to come out of it. Anyway, the interesting thing is, and it comes back really to what Sri Aurobindo was talking about, that those eastern larger states that had experienced an imperialistic background actually joined up with Yudhishthira and the Pandavas when it came to the big battle. Because Jarasandha was, you wouldn't expect his nation to join up, having been killed by Krishna and the Pandavas. And Shishupala, we really haven't got time to talk too much about him, but he runs parallel of being a close. The Chedi, he was killed also, remember, at the Rajasuriya. He actually also, the Chedis also joined the Pandavas when it came to the battle. What Sri Aurobindo said, really, there were three types of nations at that time. The nation was made up for three. And he divided them into three. You had the eastern nations, of which we've just talked about, Jarasandha. You had the central nations, and these are big heavyweights. The Panchalas, Draupadi's people, the Bhojas, and the Kurus themselves, the big heavyweights. And then you had the western and southern states, mainly smaller nations, except, of course, we had right up the west in Sindh, Joydrata. I remember the one who lost his head, he tried to abduct Draupadi. That was the only one of any weight there. So those are the three ones he divided up. And what Sri Aurobindo said, and it makes sense really, that he said, again, there were of those nations, they broke into three types of outlook. Those nations who wanted autonomy. And they were mainly the smaller. When the Aryans came down into India, a lot of them swept out of the east, and you got a lot of smaller nations there that were on the periphery of the big heavyweight nations. They hadn't actually got the same cultural development, but they were quite warlike and aggressive, and they liked autonomy. And you can like it very much to the Europeans that we have at the moment. Because you've got nations like the British, the Dutch, the Swiss, and even the Boers, going back a bit, small nations who don't really want to be tied in and have the authority over them of a larger organization. And then there were those nations that wanted to break the power of the Kurus. It could be seen that really no one was big enough to take them on and challenge them and beat them. And as I mentioned earlier, to be in the number one position. And then there were those actually who hankered after the thought of an imperial united India, ones who had experienced before. And the Magadha, Jarasandha, was one of those nations. In other words, they themselves, the Magadhas, had been a vast part, was the leader of an imperialistic. And so the flavor was there. And of course, with Shishupala, the Chedis, another big nation next to it. So you had the three elements there. And when it came to actually choosing who should go where, then you find that if you take a line from southern Mysore. Now, Mysore, if you look at India rather like an inverted pear, on the left-hand side, going down towards the bottom, Mysore is nearly coming into Tamil Nadu, the southern part of Mysore. You take a line right up to northern Gandahar, and that's actually inside Afghanistan. You go beyond New Delhi, you take a line, nearly all those states on that side were hard behind Duryodhana. Where, in fact, if you go to the eastern side, and we've been talking about them with Jarasandha, Shishtapala, the Magadhas and Chedi, those lot over there were solid behind Yudhishthira. And the central nations, the Kurus, the Panchalas, the Yadavas, were divided. For instance, if you take the Yadavas, Krishna's people, they were right in that big center block. And they, as I mentioned earlier, they were balancing because they were very smart, very warlike, and they were all very cultured. You know, they were an advanced nation. They were a little bit loose. The problem was it's really like a federation they had. And so you hadn't got the cohesion there that you might have had. But nevertheless, they had been attacked 17 times, can you believe it, by Jarasandha. There's no love lost between Krishna and Jarasandha. And in the end, you see, Krishna was away at one stage when he attacked Jarasandha, attacked him. And he was, remember, living at the time at Mathura. And Krishna came back, and when he retreated, when Jairus retreated, and Krishna actually got back too late, really, to save the city, he pulled them out. He went right over to the east coast, to Dwarka. And remember, that was so well fortified, they said that even women could, sorry about this, girls, even women could defend it. But at that time, it was very much a balancing political point. So those are the three elements there. One of the problems was with the Kuru nation at this time, of course, that it was split. You had the established leaders of the Kuru nation, Bhishma, Drona, alms teacher Vidura, and Kripa. These are wise men. They've been men in high office. They were administrators as well as their own skills and weaponry and so on. And they'd steered, particularly Bhishma, had steered the whole Kuru nation into the dominant position it had at the moment. Well, the problem was at this time, at the time of the war, you had the hotheads, the young ones who were challenging the situation, the status quo. You had Duryodhana, of course, and you had Karna, and you had Dushasana, the second Dhritarashtra's son to Duryodhana, and you had Shakuni, Uncle Shakuni, but of course he had his own agenda. And so in some ways that sort of weakened their position as well. So you can see right from the start, right early back, the whole plan, the whole deck was cleared so that this battle would be won and the goal of Vishnu, the goal of Krishna would be attained. And even the elements of getting rid of Jarasandha, and we must talk about perhaps Shishtapala later, we're running out of time for that, I'm afraid. They had to be got out of the way, not only because they were a block to the whole military situation and the people who'd be supporting Yudhishthira, but also there was a personal aspect, and I can't really say it interfered too much with the judgment of Krishna, but in actual fact, Jarasandha was after the same girl as Krishna was, Rohini. And what happened was that Jarasandha arranged to marry her. Rohini didn't want to marry him at all. She wanted to marry Krishna. And there was one of these capture things at the last moment. So there's a bit of bad blood there. And of course, because of the continual attacking of the Magadhas against the Yadavas nation. Just two things I'll mention before I go, and it really emphasizes the political forces that were at play. If you remember, right up to the time of the battle, at last the negotiations had failed. Krishna says, I'll take over. I want it to be seen by the world that I've tried my best to stop this war. And so he went actually with a task force to Hastinapura to negotiate with everyone there. And when he arrived at Hastinapura, in fact, Vidura gave him a bit of a rocket. He went to stay with Vidura. He said, you know, it's very imprudent. It's not wise of you to come to Hastinapura because there are many kings here that have actually suffered at the conquest that you as a nation have carried out in the past. And also quite of those kings had gone under the umbrella of Jarasandha too. Now the other thing is that we got as far as the terrible killing of the remnants of the armies, the Pandava armies and the allied armies by Ashwatthama. Little story there, in fact, you know, and it's one the Guru tells, how that, in fact, Ashwatthama, and in fact, Krishna, I think somewhere referred to him as a person of tainted soul, or words to that effect. Anyway, the most powerful of all weapons that Krishna had was the Pasupata. Shiva had, and Drona had obtained that from him through austerities, and actually he'd given the Pasupata to Arjuna, but he'd also given it to his son Ashwatthama. Ashwatthama nagged and nagged him. Drona wasn't particularly happy about letting him have it because he didn't feel his personality. It's such a powerful weapon. You should never use it against humans. It was a, you know, such. Anyway, he had the Pasupata, and Ashwatthama went to Krishna and said, "I'll do a swap. I'll do a bargain with you. Will you let me have your disc? And I'll let you have my Pasupata." Well, Krishna was a bit taken aback. He said, "Well, yes, certainly you can. You can have. You don't have to give me any swap. You can take it." So Ashwatthama tried to lift up the disc, as he couldn't. A bit like remember Bhima lifting up the tail of Hanuman, and he couldn't do it. And of course, he was humiliated. But Krishna was really, really insulted that he should even think of that. But going back to the situation, you remember that Duryodhan was pretty saddened that Ashwatthama had acted the way he had, because it meant that the line of the Kurus had virtually been obliterated now. And so he didn't die a happy man, he died a particularly saddened man. Well, when the news got back to the Pandavas of this awful atrocity, the charioteer, Drishtadyumna, the commander-in-chief of the Pandava armies, had managed to get away. He didn't know how, but he got through there. He told them, of course, it was an enormous shock. They were fainting and all crying and all this sort of thing. It was really, I mean, imagine Draupadi, her five children just swiped out like that, deadened, heads chopped off, in a brutal, brutal situation. And she sat down and crossed her legs. She stretched her arms out, screaming and crying. And she said, bring me the diadem he wears and bring me him dead. Well, she addressed Bhima. Remember, always in the past, Bhima has been the one person that she really could get him to do whatever she wanted. And Bhima immediately got into his chariot and he sped off. Well, it didn't quite end like that, but let's see if we can finish it off next time. If you have been listening, thanks very much.